Another man whore? Sam asks. Detective Hernandez is not amused. She frowns at Sam, saying, A homeless man. He spoke to one of the cops canvassing the park about Rocky Ruiz. He says he saw two women at that fancy pool where kids sail their boats. That place was in a book, I think. I read it to my kids. Something about a mouse? Stuart Little, I say, unsure why. That's it. Nice place. That homeless man sure thinks so. He sometimes sleeps on a bench near there. But on the night Rocky was assaulted, he said he was chased away by those two women. They caught him watching as one of them washed her hands in the water. He said it looked like one of them was bleeding. I don't dare ask if he described these women. Clearly he has. The two of you match the description he gave us, Hernandez says. So I'm just going to take a wild guess and assume it really was you. Would either of you like to explain what was going on there? She folds her hands atop the table, bracelet hand on top. Under the table, my fists have become rocks, nuggets of coal being squeezed into diamonds. The pressure splits one of the scabs on my knuckles. A trickle of blood slips between my fingers. It was exactly what it looked like, I say, spinning the lie with no thought. It just comes out of my mouth. I tripped when we were crossing the park. Scraped my hand up in the process. It was bleeding pretty hard, so we went to the pool so I could rinse it off. Was this before or after the purse was stolen? Before, I say. Hernandez stares me down, her gaze hard. Beneath the neat hair and tailored blazer is one tough cookie. She probably had to work hard to get where she is. More than the men, that's for damn sure. I bet they all underestimated her. Yet so have I. And now here we are. That's interesting, she says. Our homeless friend didn't mention seeing a purse. For some reason, I stop myself. The lie disappears like a pinch of salt melting on my tongue. Hernandez leans forward, almost friendly, preparing to begin a just-us-girls chat. Listen, ladies, I don't know what went down in the park that night. Maybe Rocky was high out of his mind. Maybe he tried to hurt you and you fought back a little too hard. If that's the case, it would be in both of your best interests to come forward. She pulls back, friend time over. The bracelet scrapes across the table as she grabs her notebook again. I even get why you might not want to do that. The man's in a coma. That's a serious situation. But I swear I won't judge you. Not until I have the full story. Hernandez consults her notes, looks to Sam. Miss Stone, I'll even overlook your past brushes with the law. To her credit, Sam doesn't react. Her face is a mask of calm. But I can tell she's seeking out my reaction. My lack of one tells her everything she needs to know. I just want to be clear that none of those things will in any way affect your treatment, Hernandez says, should one of you decide to turn yourself in, of course. We won't, Sam says. Take some time to think about it. Across the table, Hernandez stands and tucks the notebook under her arm, bracelet singing. Talk it over. But don't take too long. The more you wait, the worse it will get. Oh, and if one of you did, you know, happen to do it, you better pray Rocky Ruiz comes out of that coma. Because if I find myself with an involuntary manslaughter in my lap, all bets are off. We're not saying anything. Sam announces once Hernandez leaves. We have to, I say. The two of us remain in the dining room, trapped in a heady, unbearable stillness. Sunlight slants through the window, illuminating the dust motes swirling just off the table's surface. Not daring to look at each other, we watch them like people awaiting a storm, all raw nerves and unspoken dread. Actually, we don't. Sam says. She's grasping. She's got nothing on us. It's not illegal to sit in Central Park at night. Sam, there were witnesses. A homeless man and a gigolo who saw nothing. If we tell the truth now, she'll take it easy on us. She understands. Even I don't believe this. Detective Hernandez has no intention of helping us. She's just a very smart woman doing her job. Jesus, Sam says. She was lying, Quinn. The silence resumes. We watch the dust motes dance. Why didn't you tell me you were in Indiana? I say. Sam finally looks my way. Her face is foreign, unreadable. You don't want to go there, babe. Trust me. I need answers, I say. I need the truth. The only truth you need to know is that what happened in the park is all on you. I'm just trying to save your ass. By lying? By keeping your secrets, Sam says. I know too much about you now. More than you think. She pushes away from the table. The movement prompts a rush of questions from me, each one more pleading than the last. Did you meet Lisa? Were you at her house? What else aren't you telling me? Sam turns away, dark hair whipping outward, her face a blur. It unlocks a memory of a similar sight. So faint, it's more like a memory of a memory. Sam, please? She leaves the dining room in silence. A moment later, the front door closes behind her. I remain seated, too tired to move, too worried that if I try to stand, I'll simply drop to the floor. The way Sam looked when she left replays in my head, gnawing at my memory. I've seen it before. I know I have. Suddenly I remember, which sends me hurrying to my laptop. I log on to Facebook, seeking out Lisa's profile. More condolences fill her page, hundreds of them. I ignore them and head to the pictures Lisa had posted, quickly finding the one I'm looking for, Lisa lifting a bottle of wine with a happy glow. Wine time, LOL! I study the woman in the background of the photo. The dark blur that had so fascinated me the first time I saw it. I stare at the picture, as if I can will the image into focus. The best I can do is squint, trying to make my vision as blurry as the object in the photo and hope they balance each other into clarity. It works to an extent. A white smudge emerges in the far edge of the dark blur. Within that smudge is a drop of red. Lipstick. Sam's lipstick. As bright as blood. Seeing it makes my body hum with an internal acceleration. I feel as if I've been strapped to a bottle rocket, hurtling through the ozone, streaking sparks until we both explode. 27. The kitchen is cleaned and my bags are packed by the time Jeff gets home from work. One suitcase, one carry-on. He stands in the doorway to our bedroom, blinking, as if I'm a mirage. What are you doing? I'm going with you, I say. To Chicago? I bought my ticket online. Same flight, although we can't sit together. You sure? Jeff asks. It was your idea. True. It's just very sudden. And what about Sam? You said yourself that we can leave her alone for a few days, I say. She's not a dog, remember? In truth, I hope she'll be gone when we return. Quietly, without fuss. A scorpion in such a hurry to get away that it forgets to sting. Jeff, meanwhile, looks around the bedroom as if for the last time and says, Let's hope there's something left when we get back. I'll take care of that, I say. Sam doesn't return until late in the night, long after Jeff and I have gone to bed. Before we leave for the airport in the morning, I knock on the door to her room. After several knocks and no answer, I crack open the door and peer inside. Sam's in bed, comforter pulled to her chin. The blanket ripples as she thrashes beneath it. No, she moans. Please don't. I rush to the bed and shake her by the shoulders, barely getting out of the way before she bolts upright, wide awake. What's going on? She says. A nightmare, I say. You were having a nightmare. Sam stares at me, making sure I'm not part of the bad dream. She looks like a woman just rescued from drowning, red-faced and damp. Hair sticks to her sweat-soaked cheeks in long, dark strands that resemble seaweed. She even does a little shake, as if trying to flick away excess water. Whoa, she says. That was a bad one. I sit on the edge of the bed, tempted to ask her what she was dreaming about. Was it Calvin Whitmer and his sack-covered face? Or was it something else? Maybe Lisa bleeding out in the bathtub. But Sam keeps looking at me, knowing something is about to happen. Jeff and I are going away for a few days, I say. Where? Chicago? Are you kicking me out? I can't afford a hotel. I know, I say, keeping my tone calm and even. Nothing I say can upset her. That's vital. You can stay here while we're gone. Kind of like a house sitter. Maybe do some baking if you feel like it. I'm down with that, Sam says. Can Jeff and I trust you? A pointless question. Of course I don't trust her. It's why I'm going to Chicago with Jeff in the first place. Leaving her behind is my only option. Sure. I remove the cash I had stuffed into my pocket right before coming into the room. 2 rumpled $100 bills. I hand them to Sam. Here's some walking around money, I say. Use it for food, maybe go to the movies. Whatever. It's a bribe and Sam knows it. Rubbing the bills together, she says. Don't house sitters also get some sort of fee? You know, for looking after the place. Making sure everything's fine. While she frames it as a perfectly reasonable question, it doesn't keep the betrayal I feel from stinging like a slap. I remember Sam's first night here. How Jeff flat out asked if she had come seeking money. She denied it, and I had believed her. Now I get the feeling that's the only reason she's here. The late night talks, the baking, the entire friendship was just a means to that end. How does 500 sound? I say. Sam appraises the room. I can see her doing the math in her head, weighing the potential value of each object. 1,000 sounds better, she says. I grit my teeth. Of course. I leave to fetch my purse, returning with a check made payable to Tina Stone and post-dated for the day after Jeff and I are scheduled to return. Sam says nothing when she sees the date. She simply folds the check in half and places it with the cash on the nightstand. Do you still want me here when you get back? She says. That's up to you. Sam smiles. It really is, isn't it? On the plane, the solo traveler next to me kindly agrees to switch places with Jeff, allowing us to sit together. During takeoff, Jeff grabs my hand and gives it a gentle squeeze. After landing and checking into our hotel, we have an entire afternoon and evening alone together. Gone is the awkwardness of 2 nights ago, when Sam's absence was as noticeable as a missing pinky finger. We stroll the downtown blocks around our hotel, the tension from the past week thawing in the breeze blowing off Lake Michigan. I'm glad you came along, Quinn, Jeff says. I know it didn't seem that way last night, but I mean it. When he reaches for my hand, I gladly take it. It helps having him in my corner, especially considering what I intend to do. On the walk back to the hotel, we're both taken with a dress in a boutique window. It's black and white, with a cinched waist and a skirt that flares outward like a 1950s-era Dior. Right off the Paris plane, I say, quoting Grace Kelly in Rear Window. Think it will sell? Jeff stammers, Jimmy Stewart style. Well, see, that depends on the quote. A steal at $1,100? I say, still Grace. That dress should be listed on the stock exchange. Jeff drops the charade, becoming himself again. And I think you should buy it. Really? I say, also turning into myself again. Jeff flashes that widescreen smile. It's been a rough week. You deserve something nice. Inside the shop, I'm relieved to learn the dress's price tag is slightly less than my Grace Kelly estimate. Discovering that it fits brings more relief. I buy it on the spot. A dress like that deserves an occasion to match, Jeff tells me. I think I know just the place. We dress for dinner. Me in my new frock and Jeff in his sharpest suit. Thanks to the hotel concierge, we're able to get a late reservation at the city's hippest, most crazy expensive restaurant. At Jeff's encouragement, we splurge on the 9-course tasting menu, washing it down with a bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon. Dessert is a chocolate souffle so divine that I beg the pastry chef for the recipe. Back at the hotel, buzzed on wine and our foreign surroundings, we're flirtatious and sensual. I kiss him slowly while unknotting his tie, the stubbled silk winding around my fingers. Jeff takes his time with my dress. I shiver as he inches the zipper lower, my back arching. His breath grows heavier when the dress drops to the floor. He grips my arms, hurting them just a little. There's lust in his eyes, a wildness I haven't seen for ages. It makes him look like a stranger, dangerous and unknowable. I'm reminded of all those rough-and-tumble frat boys and football players I had slept with after Pine Cottage, the ones not afraid to yank off my panties and flip me over the bed, the ones who didn't care who I was or what I wanted. My body trembles. This is promising. This is what I need. But then it's gone. The mood falling away with the same ease as Jeff's tie slipping from my hands. I'm not even aware of its passing until we're on the bed and Jeff is inside me, suddenly his usual maddeningly conscientious self, asking me how I feel, asking me what I want. I want him to stop caring about my needs. I want him to shut up and take what he wants. None of that happens. The sex ends the way it normally does, with Jeff spent and me stretched on my back, a tight lump of dissatisfaction in my gut. Jeff showers afterward, returning to bed pink and tender. What's on your agenda for tomorrow? He asks, voice distant, already sailing on the boat to dreamland. The usual sights, the Art Institute, the Bean. Maybe some more shopping? Nice. Jeff sleepily murmurs. You'll have fun. That's why I came along, I say, when, in fact, it's not. Fun has nothing to do with my reason for coming here. Jeff has nothing to do with it either. While he was in the shower, washing off the sweat and smell of humdrum sex, I was on my phone, reserving a rental car. In the morning, I'm going to drive to Indiana and finally get some answers. 28. Roughly 230 miles lie between Chicago and Muncie, and I drive them as fast as my rented Camry will allow. My goal is to get to Lisa's house and see if I can learn something, anything, before returning to the city by evening. The trip is long, about 7 hours total, but if I keep a quick pace, I can be back before Jeff knows I'm gone. On the way there, I make good time, stopping just once at a convenience store off I-65. It's one of those sad generic places that wants you to think it's part of a chain, but the seams show. All those sticky soda cans, scuffed floor tiles, and racks of nudie mags wrapped in condoms of clear plastic. I buy a bottle of water, a granola bar, and a pack of cheese crackers. The breakfast of champions. A rack of silvery lighters sits on the counter. When the stoner clerk cracks open a fresh roll of pennies for the register, I grab one and stuff it into my pocket. He catches me, smiles, sends me off with a wink. Then I'm back in the car, marking my time by the way the sunlight slants across the flat ribbon of asphalt. The scenery streaking past the window is rural and stark. The houses have stripped siding and leaning porches. Miles of fields fly by, their corn stalks reduced to stubs. Exit signs point to small towns with misleadingly exotic names: Paris, Brazil, Peru. By the time the sun has become an unblinking yellow eye directly overhead, I'm steering through Muncie, searching for the address Lisa gave me in case I ever wanted to write. I find her house on a quiet side street full of ranch homes and sycamore trees. Lisa's is noticeably nicer than the others, with fresh paint on the shutters and pristine patio furniture on the front porch. A circular flower bed sits in the middle of the well-trimmed lawn, a fiberglass bird bath rising from its center like a giant mushroom. A station wagon with a PBA sticker slapped to its back bumper sits in the driveway. Definitely not Lisa's car. After parking on the street, I check myself in the rearview mirror, making sure I look somber and curious, not deranged and stalkerish. At the hotel, I had taken great care in picking an outfit that walked the fine line between casual and mourning. Dark jeans, deep purple blouse, black flats. I head to the front door using the flagstone walkway that cuts through the yard. When I ring the doorbell, I hear it echo back at me from deep inside the house. The woman who answers the door is dressed in a monochrome outfit of tan slacks and beige polo shirt. Tall and angular, she might have resembled Katharine Hepburn in her younger years. Now, though, webs of wrinkles surround her hazel eyes. She brings to mind an Okie in a Walker Evans photo, thin, hard, and bone-tired. I know exactly who she is. Nancy. Can I help you? She says in a voice as blunt as a plane's wind. I have no plan about what to do or say. All that mattered was getting here. Now that I've arrived, I don't know what my next step will be. Hi, I say. I'm... Nancy nods. Quincy. I know. She looks at my fingernails, messily painted black. My right hand, with its mottled scab smarting like a sunburn across my knuckles, catches her attention. I shove it deep into my pocket. You here for the funeral? She says. I thought that already happened. Tomorrow. I should have known there'd be a delay. There had been an autopsy to contend with, plus that all-important tox report. Lisa thought a lot about the two of you, Nancy says. I know she would want you there. As would members of the press, who I assume will be arriving in droves, the clicking of their cameras punctuating the 23rd Psalm. It's probably not a good idea, I say. I'm afraid I'd be a distraction. Then it'd be real nice if you told me why you're here. I'm no genius, but I sure as hell know that Muncie's not exactly a stone's throw from New York. I'm here to learn about Lisa, I say. I'm here for details. Inside, Lisa's house is a tidy, depressing affair. The bulk of it is taken up by the living room, dining area, and kitchen, which merge together to form one giant room. The walls are covered in wood paneling, making the place feel musty and old-fashioned. It's the home of a widowed grandmother, not a 42-year-old woman. I see no signs that a murder took place here. There are no cops dusting for prints, no grim-faced CSI grunts picking through the carpet with tweezers. Those tasks are complete, results hopefully pending. Stacks of cardboard boxes, some folded, others not, clutter the living room, which has already been stripped of a few knickknacks. End tables bear dust-free circles where vases and bowls once sat. Lisa's family asked if I could start packing up her things, Nancy says. They don't want to set foot in the place anymore. Can't say I blame them. We sit at the oval dining room table. In front of her is a laminated placemat. I assume it's where Lisa usually ate her meals. A table setting for one. We talk while sipping tea from mugs with pink roses around the rims. Her full name is Nancy Scott. She's been an Indiana state trooper for 25 years, although she'll probably be retired by this time next year. She's single, never married, owns two German shepherds that are decommissioned police dogs. I was one of the first people to enter that sorority house, she says, and I was the first person to realize Lisa wasn't dead like the rest. All the other guys, and they were all guys except me, took one look at those bodies and assumed the worst. I did too, I guess. Oh, it was bad. The blood. It was just everywhere. She stops, remembering who she's talking to. I nod for her to continue. When I took one look at Lisa, I knew she was still alive. I didn't know if she'd stay that way, but somehow she pulled through. After that, I took a shine to her. She was a fighter, that girl.
And that's how the two of you became close?
Lisa and I were close in the way that you and Frank are close.
Frank.
It's disconcerting to hear him called that. To me, he's simply Coop. She knew she could call me whenever she needed to, Nancy says. But I was there to listen and help in whatever way I could. That kind of thing is delicate, you see. You need to let them know you're there for them, but not get too involved. You have to keep a distance. It's better that way. I think of Coop and all the invisible barriers he's built between us. Always nodding, never hugging, not coming up to the apartment until he absolutely had to. It's likely Nancy gave him this same spiel about keeping a distance. She doesn't strike me as the kind of woman who keeps her opinions to herself. It was only in the past 5 years or so that we became what you'd call friends, she says. I became close with her family as well. They'd have me over for Thanksgiving dinner, family birthdays.
They sound like good people, I say.
They are. They're having a hard time with this, of course. That grief will be with them for the rest of their lives.
And you, I say.
Oh, I'm furious. Nancy takes a sip of tea. Her lips pucker from the heat before flattening into a harsh line. I know I should feel sad, and I do. But more than that, I'm mad as hell. Someone took Lisa away from us. After all she went through.
I know exactly what she means. Lisa's murder feels like a defeat. A final girl finally vanquished. Did you always suspect foul play was involved?
I sure as hell did, Nancy says. I knew Lisa couldn't have killed herself. Not when she'd fought so hard to survive and had done so much with the hand she'd been dealt. I'm the one who ordered that tox report, conflict of interest be damned. I was right, of course. They found all those pills in her system, but no prescription bottle in the house to keep them in. Then they looked at the knife wounds, which is something that should have been done in the first place.
When we all spoke on the phone, you said there weren't any suspects. Has that changed?
Nope, Nancy says.
What about a motive?
Still nothing.
You sound like you don't think they'll ever catch who did it.
Because I don't, Nancy says with a sigh. By the time those idiots realized what really happened, it was too late. The scene was already compromised. Me with those boxes. Some of Lisa's friends and cousins. All of us clomping in here and dragging in God knows what. She leans forward, looks to the table. The whole time, that circle of wine sat right here. From the glass, no one knew was missing.
Whoever killed Lisa took it with him. It's probably smashed on the side of the road somewhere. Tossed out a car window.
My hands are resting on the table's surface, palms flat. I quickly pull them away.
They already dusted for prints, Nancy says. Couldn't find any. Same with the bathroom, the knife, and Lisa's phone. All wiped clean.
And none of her friends know anything? I ask.
They're asking around. But it's been hard. Lisa liked to be around people. She was very social.
Nancy's disapproval is obvious. She spits the word out as if it might leave a bad taste in her mouth. You don't think she should have been, I say.
I thought she was too trusting. Because of what she went through, she was always willing to help people in need. Girls, mostly. Troubled ones.
Troubled how?
Girls who were at risk. Having trouble with their parents. Or maybe running away from a boyfriend who liked smacking them around. Lisa took them in, looked out for them, helped them get back on their feet. I saw it as her trying to fill the void in her life caused by that night at the sorority house.
Void? I say.
Lisa didn't date very much, Nancy says. She didn't trust too many men with good reason. Like most girls, she probably once had dreams of getting married, having kids, being a mom. That day at the sorority house took all that away from her.
So she never dated?
A little, Nancy replies. Nothing that ever got very serious. Most guys split once they found out what happened to her.
Did she mention any of them to you? Maybe about one of them harassing her? Or did she ever talk about having problems with one of the girls she befriended? Sam, that's who I really mean. Did Lisa ever mention Samantha Boyd?
Not to me.
Nancy drains her teacup. She looks at mine, clearly hoping I'll do the same and take my leave.
How long are you in town for, Quincy?
I check my watch. It's 1:15. I need to be on the road by 2:30 if I want to make it back to Chicago without arousing Jeff's suspicions. Another hour? I look around the half-packed room, then the empty boxes leaning flat against the wall. Need some help?
29.
I offer to work in Lisa's bedroom while Nancy continues in the living room. She agrees, although she bites the inside of her mouth before consenting, as if she's unsure I can be trusted. But then she hands me two boxes.
Don't worry about trying to sort stuff, she says, pointing me down the hallway. Her family will do that. We just need to empty the place.
Finally out of her sight, I linger in the hall, looking into each of the three rooms located there. The first one is a guest room, sparsely furnished and immaculately clean. I step inside and roam its perimeter, my index finger running along the dresser, the bed, the nightstand. There's no trace of Sam, even though I can picture her smoking by the open window, just like she's probably doing in my apartment at this very moment. I move back to the hall, pausing at the bathroom. This room I refuse to enter. Doing so would feel like invading a crypt. Besides, I have a good enough view from the hall. From sink to tub to toilet, the bathroom is a sea of light blue, still smudged in spots by traces of the aluminum powder used to dust for prints. I stare at the tub, unnerved. Lisa died right there. I think of her lying in that tub, surrounded by cloudy pink water. I then think of Sam standing in the doorway just like I'm doing, watching, making sure the job is complete. When I can't look at that tub a second longer, I head to Lisa's bedroom, trying hard to shake off the chill that suddenly come over me. The bedroom is all cream and pink. Cream carpet, pink curtains, rose-colored comforter over the bed. A treadmill stands in the corner, covered with dust and draped with clothes. I wonder if Lisa ever spent one of our phone conversations in here, doling out advice while walking on the treadmill,
or maybe sprawled across the bed. The memory of her phone voice returns. You can't change what's happened. The only thing you can control is how you deal with it. I go to Lisa's dresser, the top of which is littered with hair accessories, plastic bins overflowing with makeup, and an old-school jewelry box. When I lift its lid, a porcelain ballerina in a tiny tulle skirt pops up and begins to spin. On the other side of the dresser are several snapshots stuck into plastic frames meant to resemble wood. There's Lisa at the beach with Nancy, both of them squinting into the sun. Lisa, with whom I can only assume are her parents, standing before a Christmas tree. Lisa at the Grand Canyon, at a bar with neon behind her and a hand on her shoulder bearing a red ring, at a birthday party with cake smeared on her face. I empty the dresser one drawer at a time, grabbing bunches of Lisa's bras, socks, and granny panties. I remove the clothes quickly, trying to ignore the guilt-inducing fact that I'm snooping. It feels like a violation of sorts, as if I've broken into her home and started to ransack the place. It's the same thing when I go to the closet and begin clearing it of dresses, pantsuits, and sad floral skirts that went out of style years ago. But then I find what I was hoping for. There's a gray lockbox in a back corner of the closet, partially obscured by a hamper. It's small, boasting a single drawer. I notice a tiny keyhole in that lone drawer, similar to the one located in my secret drawer at home. And just like on my drawer, the keyhole is circled by a pattern of scratch marks made when the lock was picked. Now I know for certain that Sam was here. Those scratch marks were her handiwork. They had to be. My hand drifts to the necklace that holds the key to my drawer. I still wear it, despite being so far from home. It gives me a sense of normalcy when, in truth, everything about my life has been upended by Sam. I give the drawer a tug and it slides open. Three neatly stacked file folders sit inside it. The top one is blue and unlabeled. Opening it, I see a scrapbook of sorts, page after photocopied page of newspaper clippings, magazine articles, stories printed off the internet. All of them are about the sorority house massacre. Some of the articles have sentences underlined in blue pen. Question marks and sad faces crowd the margins. The other two folders are red and white. One is about Sam. The other concerns me. I know that even without opening them. The math is simple. Three final girls, three folders. Sam's folder is the red one. Inside are articles about the Nightlight Inn, including the one from Time magazine that traumatized me as a child. Lisa made notes in those, too. Words, phrases, and whole sentences have been scribbled in the margins. In the back of the folder are two newspaper clippings, both of them missing dates. Hemlock Creek, Pennsylvania. Authorities are continuing to investigate the deaths of two campers found stabbed to death last month. Police discovered the bodies of Tommy Curran, 24, and Susie Pavkovic, 23, inside a tent in a heavily wooded area 2 miles outside of town. Both victims had been stabbed multiple times. Although there were signs of a struggle at their campsite, authorities say nothing appeared to be taken from the scene, leading them to conclude robbery was not a factor in their deaths. The grisly crime has left many in this quiet town on edge. It comes barely a year after the body of a 20-year-old woman was found along Valley Road, a little-traveled access road used by employees of Blackthorn Psychiatric Hospital. The woman, whom authorities could never identify, was strangled to death. Police think she was killed elsewhere and later dumped in the woods. Police say the two crimes are unrelated. Hazleton, Pennsylvania. A man was found stabbed to death yesterday inside the home he shared with his wife and stepdaughter. Responding to emergency calls, Hazleton police found Earl Potash, 46, dead in the kitchen of his Maple Street duplex, the victim of multiple stab wounds to the chest and stomach. Authorities have ruled the incident a homicide. The investigation is continuing. I press a hand to my forehead. My skin is hot to the touch. That's because of the reference to Blackthorne in the first article. The name always makes me break into a nervous sweat. Although I can't remember how, I know I've heard about those murders in the woods. They took place a year or so before Pine Cottage, in the very same forest. Why Lisa kept this news clipping in a folder devoted to Sam is beyond my comprehension. A second read doesn't make things any clearer, so I tuck the clippings back into the folder and put it away. Now it's time for the white folder. My folder. The first thing I see upon opening it is a single sheet of paper. My name is on it. So is my phone number. Now it starts to make more sense. Now I know how Sam got my phone number to call me the night she was arrested. Next are articles about Pine Cottage, fastened together with a pink paperclip. I flip the stack over without looking at it, fearing I'll see another picture of him. Beneath the articles is a letter. The letter. The bad one that made even Coop nervous. You shouldn't be alive. You should have died in that cabin. It was your destiny to be sacrificed. Shock blasts through me. I start to gasp but stop myself, afraid Nancy will be able to hear it. Instead, I stare at the letter, not blinking, those out-of-place zeros like several sets of eyes staring back. A single question stabs into my thoughts. The obvious one. How the fuck did Lisa get a copy? Another, more pressing question follows. Why did she have it? Behind the letter, also paperclipped, is the transcript of a police interview. At the top is my name and a date. 1 week after Pine Cottage. Neatly typed below that are the names of two people I haven't thought of in years, Detective Cole and Detective Fremont. Nancy's voice rings out from the end of the hall, on the move, getting closer. Quincy? I shut the folder with a snap. I lift the back of my shirt, press the folder flat against my spine, and shove it down the seat of my pants far enough so that it won't flop out when I walk. I then tuck in my blouse, hoping Nancy won't notice how it was untucked when I arrived. The other two folders are dropped back into the filing cabinet. The drawer is shoved shut just as Nancy sweeps into the room. She eyes the boxes first, then me, rising from my crouch in front of Lisa's closet. "Your time's about up," she says. She's back to looking at the boxes. Both are only partially filled. One of them has a pair of Lisa's jeans flopped over the side. "I'm sorry I didn't get more done," I say. "Packing up Lisa's stuff is harder than I thought it would be. It means she's really gone." We each carry a box to the living room, me letting Nancy lead the way. When we say our goodbyes at the door, I worry she'll attempt a hug. I stiffen at the prospect of her bony arms sliding over the folder jutting at my back. But apparently she's like Coop when it comes to hugs. She doesn't even shake my hand. She simply purses her lips, the wrinkles around them bunching. "Take care of yourself, hon," she says.
1 week after Pine Cottage. Good cop and bad cop stared at Quincy, expecting something she couldn't provide. Detective Fremont, that old bulldog, looked rough around the edges, as if he hadn't slept in days. Quincy noticed he wore the same jacket from their first interview, its glaring mustard stain still intact. Detective Cole, on the other hand, remained a handsome devil, in spite of the bristle on his upper lip that wanted to be a mustache. Its edges flared when he smiled at her. You're probably nervous. He said, don't be. Yet Quincy was very nervous. Only 2 days out of the hospital, and she was in a police station, pushed there in a wheelchair by her exasperated mother because it still hurt to walk. What a hassle, her mother said on the drive there. Don't they see how much of an inconvenience this is? Her mother had been cleaning the upstairs bathroom when the call came, answering the phone with hands encased in flopping rubber gloves. Hassle or not, she nonetheless changed into a floral print dress before leaving for the station. Quincy remained in pajamas and a bathrobe, much to her mother's abject horror. Is something wrong? Quincy asked as she stared at the two detectives from her wheelchair, wondering why she had been summoned there. We just have a few more questions, Call said.
I've already told you everything I know, Quincy said.
Fremont gave a sorry shake of his head.
Which is a whole lot of nothing.
Listen, we don't want you to think we're harassing you, Call said. We just need to make sure we know everything that happened out at that cabin. For the families, surely you can understand that. Quincy didn't want to think about all those grieving parents and siblings and friends. Janelle's mother had visited her in the hospital. Red-eyed and trembling, she begged Quincy to tell her that Janelle hadn't suffered, that her daughter had felt no pain when she died.
She didn't feel a thing, Quincy lied. I'm sure of it.
I understand, she told Cole. I want to help. I really do.
The detective reached into a briefcase at his feet and pulled out a file folder, which he placed on the table. Next came a metallic rectangle, a tape recorder, now set atop the folder. We're going to ask you a few questions, he said. If you don't mind, we'd like to record the conversation. Anxiety flickered through Quincy as she stared at the tape recorder.
Sure,
she said, the word emerging in an uneasy wobble. Cole pressed the record button before saying, Now tell us, Quincy, to the best of your ability, what you remember about that night.
The whole night? Or when Janelle started screaming? Because I don't remember much after that.
The whole night.
Well?
Quincy paused, shifting slightly to peer out the window set into the upper half of the door. The door itself had been closed once her mother was asked to wait outside. The window's square pane revealed only a bit of ivory-colored wall and the corner of a poster warning about the dangers of drunk driving. Quincy couldn't see her mother. She couldn't see anyone.
We know there was drinking, Fremont said, and marijuana use.
There was, Quincy admitted. I didn't do either.
A good girl, eh?
Fremont said. Yes.
But it was a party, Call said.
Yes.
And Joe Hannon was there. Quincy flinched at the sound of his name. Her three stab wounds, still stitched tight, began to throb.
Yes.
Did something happen during the party?
Fremont asked.
Something that made him angry? Did anyone tease him, abuse him, maybe hurt him in a way that would make him want to lash out?
No, Quincy said.
Did anything happen that made you angry?
No,
Quincy said again, stressing the word, hoping it would make the lie somehow ring true.
We looked at the results of your sexual assault forensic exam, Fremont said.
He was referring to the rape kit Quincy endured once her wounds had been stitched up. She didn't remember much, only staring at the ceiling and trying to hold back sobs as the nurse calmly talked her through each step.
It says you had engaged in sexual intercourse that night. Is that true?
Shame scorched Quincy's cheeks as she gave a single nod.
Was it consensual?
Fremont said.
Quincy nodded again, the hot flush spreading to her forehead, her neck.
Are you sure? It's okay to tell us if it wasn't.
It was, Quincy replied. Consensual, I mean. I wasn't raped.
Detective Cole cleared his throat, as eager as Quincy to change the subject. Let's move on. Let's talk about what happened after your friend Janelle came out of the woods and you were stabbed in the shoulder. Are you certain you can't remember anything that happened after that?
Yes.
Try, Cole suggested, just for a few minutes.
Quincy closed her eyes, trying for what felt like the 100th time that week to conjure even the faintest memory of that missing hour. She took deep breaths, each one straining her stitches. Her head began to hurt, another headache ballooning in her skull. All she saw was blackness. I'm sorry, she whimpered. I can't.
Nothing at all?
Fremont said. No.
Quincy was trembling now, on the verge of tears.
There's nothing.
Fremont crossed his arms and gave her an annoyed huff. Cole simply stared at her, squinting slightly, as if he could see her better that way.
I'm a little thirsty,
he announced, turning to Fremont. Hank, could you be a sport and get me a coffee from the vending machine? The request seemed to surprise Fremont.
Really?
Yes, please. Cole looked to Quincy. Are you allowed to have coffee?
I don't know.
We better not risk it, Cole decided. Caffeine and those pain meds you're on might not mix too well, am I right? That wouldn't be good for you, sheesh.
It was the last word that tipped Quincy off. Spoken with such forced cheer, it all but announced that it was nothing more than an act. Cole's handsome face, those warm, vaguely sexy smiles, all of it was just a charade. Cole confirmed this once Fremont was out of the room.
I'll give you credit, he told her. You're good.
You don't believe me, Quincy said.
Not one bit. But we're going to find out the truth eventually. Think about that, Quincy. Imagine how your friend's parents will feel when they find out you've been lying all this time. Sheesh.
That time, he winked as he said it. His way of telling Quincy he knew that she knew. Now, you can talk all you want about how you don't remember anything, he said, but you and I both know you do. Again, a strange shift began to take place inside Quincy, an internal hardening. Everything galvanized. She pictured her skin turning to metal, polished and gleaming. A shield protecting her from Cole's accusations. It made her feel strong.
I'm sorry my lack of memory makes you angry, she said. You can spend years asking me stuff, but until my memory comes back, my answers will always be the same.
I might just do that,
Cole replied. I'll go to your house every month. Hell, once a week. I suspect your parents will soon start to wonder why that handsome detective keeps coming over asking questions. Quincy flashed a smart-assed smile.
Only mildly handsome.
I wouldn't be smiling if I were you, Cole said. Six kids are dead, Quincy. Their parents want answers, and the only survivor is you, a wispy little girl who claims she can't remember a thing.
You actually think I did it?
I think you're certainly hiding something, possibly protecting someone. Maybe I'll change my mind if you finally tell me everything you saw that night, including the stuff you've conveniently forgotten.
I've told you everything I know, she said. What makes you think I'm lying?
Because it doesn't add up, Cole replied. Your prints are on the knife that killed all your friends.
And so are everyone else's.
Anger swelled in Quincy's chest as she thought about how many times that knife switched hands. Janelle, Amy and Betts all definitely touched it. He did, too.
And I shouldn't have to remind you of this, but I was also stabbed 3 times.
2 stab wounds to the shoulder and 1 in the abdomen, Cole said. None of them life-threatening.
Not for lack of trying.
You want to hear what the others experienced?
Cole reached for the folder atop the table. When he opened it, Quincy saw photographs. Her photographs, taken with her camera.
Of course, the police had found it at Pine Cottage and downloaded the pictures stored within it.
The detective slid a photograph across the table. It showed Janelle sticking out her tongue in front of Pine Cottage, mugging for the camera.
Janelle Bennett, he said. 4 stab wounds, 1 each to the heart, lung, shoulder, and stomach, plus a slit throat.
The comforting mental shell Quincy had felt earlier suddenly faded into nothingness. Now she was all exposed underbelly.
Stop, she murmured.
Cole ignored her, whipping out another photograph. Craig, this time, standing heroically atop the rock they had hiked to.
Craig Anderson, 6 stab wounds, ranging in depth from 2 to 6 inches.
Please. Next came the photo of Rodney and Amy squeezing each other on the hike. Quincy remembered what she'd said while taking it. Make love to the camera.
Rodney's spelling, Cole said. 4 stab wounds, 2 to the abdomen, 1 on his arm, 1 in the heart.
Stop! Quincy screamed, loud enough to bring in Fremont and a uniformed cop who hovered in the doorway. She recognized him immediately. Officer Cooper, fixing her with a protective blue-eyed stare. The mere sight of him filled her with relief.
What's going on in here? He asked. Quincy, are you okay?
Quincy looked at him, still on the verge of tears, but refusing to let them see her cry. Tell him, she begged. Tell him I didn't do anything. Tell him I'm a good person. Officer Cooper moved to her side, making Quincy think he was about to hug her. She welcomed it. She wanted to feel safe in someone's arms. Instead, he put a large, steady hand on her shoulder.
You're a wonderful person, he said, addressing her but looking squarely at Detective Cole. You're a survivor.
30. A big rig thunders by, horn streaking as it rocks the Camry parked on the highway's shoulder. I sit in the front passenger seat, legs bent out the open door. The interior light throws a dim halo over my hands and the folder gripped between them. It's opened to the transcript of my interview with Fremont and that asshole Cole. Seeing the first few lines is all it takes to remember. Cole. Now, tell us, Quincy, to the best of your ability, what you remember about that night. Carpenter. The whole night? Or when Janelle started screaming? Because I don't remember much after that. Cole. The whole night. I toss the transcript aside, unwilling to read further. I don't need to relive that conversation. Once was enough. Beneath the transcript are several pages of emails, printed out and stapled together. All were sent during the same time period, 3 weeks ago.
Miss Milner. Yes, I do know who you are and what happened all those years ago. I humbly offer my belated condolences and wish to say I admire the courage and fortitude you've displayed all these years. That is why I've attached the transcript of our recorded interview with Miss Carpenter that you so kindly requested. Although others may not, I understand your curiosity about Miss Carpenter. You two went through very similar ordeals. It's been a long time since my dealings with Miss Carpenter, but I remember them well. My partner and I interviewed her several times after the events at Pine Cottage. We both felt she wasn't telling the truth. It was my gut feeling.